Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is the MyMac publisher, Tim Robertson. Tim, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you, John?
I am very good. Thank you for joining me on the show. How are you?
I couldn't be better. If I was any better, I would be you or Brian Chafin.
You've been talking to Brian lately. What was that?
Well, Brian wrote a book. And
oh, that's right.
He wanted people to read it and give their opinion. I did. But we also talked about the publishing of the book. In fact, that's probably half of our conversation. He wants to go one route. I would love to see him go another route with it. But that's been the discussion. It's a good book, though. Really, really good.
Yeah, Brian has written a science fiction novel. I read the first incarnation of it a while back, and I had some feedback for him, too. I think that resulted in some changes to the opening chapters. Yeah, I wish him all the best with that.
Absolutely. It's one of these books that when you're done reading it, you think, especially knowing that it's not published, you think, oh, you got to get this out there. You got to get this thing published.
Well, yeah, sometimes the first book is your business card, too. You know,
that's true.
It proves that you can write, 100,000 words and create a coherent story. It's sort of like, hey, look, you know, I can do this.
And but you got to get it out there.
Yeah, you do. And I think once you get it done, you sort of have to kind of put it behind you. I've always often toyed with the idea of doing more fiction. I remember writing some fiction for Joe Ryan back when I was writing for Apple Links.
That was a great site. You, John Farr, that was one of my favorite sites in the world back in the day.
It was awesome. John Farr was the managing editor for Joe Ryan of a site called AppleLinks.com. I joined them somewhere around 97, and John Farr was my mentor as a writer, and he's still a great writer. He's doing writing about life in Taos, New Mexico, and he has a couple of websites, Buffalo Lights and his home site for John Farr, and he's just an awesome writer. See, he's so observant, such a great photographer, and he marries spectacular photography of New Mexico with awesome observations about life in that state. So,
yeah, anyway. He's out there a little bit as far as some of his beliefs and what he's into, but I've always loved the guy. You know,
he's
one of those guys. I hope he is as successful as he deserves to be, and unfortunately, like a lot of people, I don't think he is. But that's kind of the life we live sometimes.
Yeah, it's kind of tough finding a good place for him to stay in Taos too. But let's don't talk about John too much. Let's talk about you.
Uh-oh.
You started MyMac at the dawn of the internet age, maybe a little before, back in, 95?
1995, yeah. It was, I was going through the end of my first marriage. Thankfully, I'm remarried, and it's the right person. We've been together a very long time now. But towards the end of 94, my daughter was born, my oldest. And I thought, she's going to need to know how to use these computer things. I was not into computers at all. I was a jock. I was a guy who played football. I like to drive fast cars and work on them. That was me.
Oh, what kind of fast cars?
My fastest was a 72 Buick Skylark. That thing scared the crap out of me.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Was that one of those that had, 300 horsepower or something?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was, when I bought it for $80. And the lady I bought it from, it was her son's, and she used to take it up to this local drag strip called 131 Speedway, which is still there. And he would race it all the time, but he joined the military years before, so it was sitting in her yard, and I picked it up for $80. Wow. I had $100, but I needed the other 20 for gas to get the car back home.
Because it got 13 miles per gallon.
I think it got 13 gallons per mile. I mean, this thing was horrible on gas. But gas was 98 cents, so I didn't care. But I still needed that 20 bucks to get it back home. And it was just the scariest car I ever drove. So that was my background. It was playing football and watching football, racing cars in Marshall, Michigan, That's what I was into, and computers, quite frankly, scared me.
Marshall, Michigan. I grew up in northern Indiana, but I don't remember Marshall.
Marshall is real close to Battle Creek. It's a very small town.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But they have a downtown strip that, at least back in my day, in the late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s, and late 80s, people would take their really nice cars or their fast cars, and they would cruise the strip.
I never knew that about you.
Yeah,
I'm trying to picture Tim Robertson in his Buick Skylark.
Oh, I had long
strolling
hair.
Down the strip with cigarette in hand.
Yeah. That was me, and I had the hair down to my shoulders.
My God.
It was the 80s, man. And I won some money with that car. I used to, I'd pull up next to like a brand new 89 Camaro, and they would smirk at me, and we'd get away from the strip to this good quarter, well, it was about a half mile long piece of asphalt, and we'd race.
Oh, my. Oh,
the guy, when I finally broke the car in half, literally, I broke the frame in half on a really bad wintry day on I-94, a guy I used to beat in his Camaro, he bought the car from me just for the engine, and he paid me $150. So I drove that car for a year and broke it in half and more than doubled my money. So I was happy.
Yeah, I had Julie Cool on the show recently, and we were talking about cars, and she loves Mustangs. And my first car was a Mustang Mach 1 with the black anti-glare hood and a Cleveland 351. And I almost killed myself in that car twice.
So I was scared. That's who I was. And I just thought, my daughter's going to need to know all of these computers, because by the time she gets, you know, into adulthood, everybody's going to have a computer. And remember, this was the mid-90s. Not everybody had a computer.
Right.
So my then wife and I went to the store, and there was so many different computers, I didn't know what to get. So I did a little research. Found some computer magazines, and the consensus that I came up with was that the Mac was easier to use, an Apple computer. So that's what I bought. I bought a Performa 410, which, looking back, was
performance.
Yes, right. And it was a dog. I mean, it was really slow, but I didn't know any better. And it was kind of intuitive for me, to be honest. I started using.
Was that a Motorola 68K thing, or was that?
Yeah, yes. No,
6040?
No, 030.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I think it had 2 megs of RAM. I think it had a 40 megabyte hard drive. It could have been 20.
Megabytes of RAM, not gigabytes.
Not gigabytes,
megabytes of RAM.
And it came with a 14.4 modem.
Built in?
No, I wish. And so I bought the StyleWriter printer with it, and I think I bought the modem as well. I think it was a US Robotics, maybe, or Global Village.
Was that
Village.
That little thermal printer, the StyleWriter?
No. It was an inkjet printer, and you put the paper on the top, and it came out the bottom.
Oh, okay. I had the little thermal printer. That would cost me an arm and a leg.
Yeah. Well, I got mine in a bundle, and it was the printer was basically free with this bundle that I bought. So I was happy. And I got it home, I set it up, and it scared me. You know, it's a computer. And I accidentally hit a power switch at one point and turned it back on, and the computer yelled at me and said, "You did not shut down properly." And I thought, oh, okay, I guess this is kind of bossy. And then, I don't know, the next day it froze. You know, back in the day when an application would crash, it would take the whole system down.
Sure.
So I couldn't move the mouse, and I couldn't go to the special menu to shut it down, so I didn't know what to do. So I called 1-800-SOS-APPLE, half hour on hold. I finally get this lady, and I tell her what's going on. She goes, "We'll just turn it off and turn it back on." I said, "Well, I can't. That my mouse isn't moving." She goes, "No, just turn off the switch and turn it back on in the back." I said, I thought you weren't supposed to do that." She goes, "Well, no, it's not going to hurt it. You'll be fine." And that's when I lost my fear of computers. When I realized it's a TV, I could turn it off and turn it back on, and I'm good to go. I lost my fear, and I just started experimenting with it. I signed up for AOL, CompuServe, eWorld. We had a local
E-World
first class.
Was E-World. Apple's version of a bulletin board system.
I've got an eWorld story I could tell you later if you remind me.
Oh, tell us now.
Okay. So this is years later. I was not happy with the MyMac name. It was a name that I came up with for the publication at the last minute. I had written the entire first issue, and I didn't know what to call it. I thought MacSense would be great, but there was already a MacSense, and it was really good. And so I just came up with My Mac. I thought, well, I made this thing on My Mac. I'll just call it My Mac, and eventually I'll come up with a better name. After years after Apple had finally killed eWorld, I had contacted Fred Anderson at Apple. He was head of the legal department then. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'd really love to either buy or license the eWorld name. You guys aren't using it for anything. The URL just simply directs to apple.com. I think it would be an excellent name for my downloaded digital magazine.
I'm guessing how that went.
Well, they were receptive.
Really?
They were very receptive, and they said it might take a little while. Well, a little while turned into like 3 months, and I wasn't getting any emails back. So I thought, well, one last Hail Mary. So I actually emailed Steve Jobs, and I said, here's the thing. I was talking to Fred Anderson, blah, blah, blah. I'd really like to use this name. And I got a reply, and he says, yeah, we don't want to give up the name, but thanks. I was like, crap, I kind of blew my chance there. The very next day, I get a FedEx envelope from Apple Legal, a licensing agreement to use the eWorld name. It was like 10 pages. Uh-oh. It was $2,000 a month. They were very strict on how I had, it had to be
licensing
the
licensing fee, $2,000 a month?
$2,000 a year.
Oh, okay.
The lowercase e, capital letter W, it had to be just like that every time. Mm-hmm. So I was in a quandary. Steve Jobs himself had told me, no way. The next day I get a legal agreement from Apple to license the name.
Did you go back to Fred?
No, I didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I just decided, you know what? I've invested a couple years now into the My Mac brand, if you will. I think I'm just going to ride this one out. It was a better choice. And looking back now, it definitely was the right choice. But
what's cool about that is that you could actually, you know, engage Fred Anderson and Steve Jobs and, you know, get something done.
Yeah, and I did.
Yeah. Well, so, let's go back to My Mac.
Mm-hmm.
When you had, we all had modems and we were going into bulletin board systems. Did My Mac start as a downloadable document kind of
application? Yeah, it did. What happened was I always wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to either write fiction, maybe science fiction, but that seemed very daunting. The next thing I wanted to do is I wanted to be a comic book writer, not an artist. I can't draw a straight line, but I grew up with comic books, and I thought, well, it's the writers who craft the stories. You know, they're the guys that make these things cool. The artists are just as important. They visually make it cool, but without the writer, you don't have anything. You just have pretty pictures. Or I wanted to be a reviewer at Stereo Review Magazine, which doesn't exist anymore.
I used to subscribe to that.
Oh, I loved Stereo Review Magazine. Oh, loved it. I was a big audiophile for years. Still am, but
yeah, me too.
Not like that.
Yeah, my first receiver was a Kenwood receiver, and I had mm-hmm. some big boxy speakers. Yeah.
And so I thought, before I even attempt to write for somebody else, maybe I should, you know, practice my writing. Writers write. So I knew I wanted to practice writing, but I wanted someone to read it. Otherwise, you're just writing into a void. You don't know if it's any good. You're not going to get any constructive or non-constructive criticism. So I decided I was going to write about this Mac that I'm sitting in front of. I was downloading a lot of programs. And one of the programs that I downloaded was called DocMaker. Now, your listeners have to realize that back then, to share documents, the other person had to have the same application. Otherwise, the formatting was just gone, and you couldn't put any pictures or anything like that. PDF did not exist yet. And so DocMaker would allow you to create a digital magazine or book, if you will.
Ah, yes.
And the export was actually not a document, but an application itself. So when other people opened it, as long as they had the same fonts installed, and it was pretty safe, if you just only use the Macintosh system fonts, you'll be fine. I learned that the hard way. They could open it up and see it formatted the way you actually created it. So it was really...
Did you charge for this publication?
I tried at one point. I had a deluxe edition. It lasted about a year, and I gave up on it. But the first issue was just me writing about shareware and stuff like that. And I posted it on eWorld, AOL, and a local BBS system that was running the first class software. And I got some pretty good positive results. And this lady on the Great Lakes Freenet said, hey, I really enjoy this. Could I write a review for it? Well, yeah, of course. I couldn't believe it. And before I knew it, I was putting out an episode or an issue every month. The list of contributors were getting bigger and bigger. They weren't getting paid. Neither was I.
This was a labor of love from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just kept getting larger and more people. And before I knew it, we were putting out what I seriously considered a rival to any other digital magazine at the time, as well as like Macworld. I mean, our content was all original. Reviews, opinions, we were getting tons of feedback, so we had a letter page. It was just so much fun. And we just really never stopped. I mean, it's 2016, but our roots are in 1995. That is where we started.
Those were kind of fun days because everything was kind of new and you didn't have to worry about threats and security. You had this new machine. You could dial up. You could go anywhere, do anything, download a blog, download a magazine. And we were just all learning by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was kind of addictive that as a publisher, I can go on like eWorld or AOL and see how many times it was downloaded. I remember seeing one issue actually broke 100 downloads on AOL, and I was 100 people downloaded it and was reading it. Wow. But you had to be careful. You couldn't make it more than 1 megabyte, because if it was more than 1 megabyte, almost nobody would download it because that's just too big. On a 14.4 or a 36 or a 56K modem.
Of course.
Yeah, so that was kind of the origins of my Mac. It was for me to practice my writing so I could write for someone else. I didn't realize then that it would grow into what it became.
Cool. Guess what? We have to take a break. I want to talk to you some more about this. Folks, when we come back with Tim Robertson, we'll continue the discussion. But first, a word from the Mac Observer. Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. We're back. I'm chatting with Tim
Robertson. I met Kelly. I met her.
She's cool, isn't she?
She is. She's really cool. I liked her a lot.
She is sharp as a tack, so verbal, so savvy in all affairs, computers, not just Apple, everything.
It was at the at one or two of the Mac Tech conferences in Manhattan Beach in California. She's great.
Yeah, she is doing social media now for Smile, and she's working on App Camp. I've had her on the show, App Camp for Girls. Had her on the show. She's just delightful. So then there came a time when you and I finally met. I think we met for the first time at a party I organized in Macworld San Francisco in 2000.
Yep. And that's one of my favorite expos. In fact, I would say that's my favorite Macworld Expo to date.
We were talking about that earlier. Tell me about that.
Well, there was something special. Number one, it was my first Macworld Expo. And obviously, we don't have Macworld Expos anymore. But at the time, that was the Mecca. There was two a year, either New York and Boston or San Francisco. And I wanted to go to the one in San Francisco because it's January or February. I forget which it was. I think it was January then.
It was always the first weekend after the New Year.
That's right. Yeah. So it was January.
Crazy. Yeah.
And I live in Michigan, so the thought of going to a nicer climate was better than going to Boston or New York in the middle of the summer. That didn't sound as appealing. But it was my first Macworld Expo. It was the first time that we saw what became OS X. It was called Rhapsody.
Rhapsody, yes.
Yeah. It scared me to death because at the time, full-time, I was an IT manager in a graphic design firm. and it was other than
why did it scare you?
Because it was Unix-based, and I didn't know anything about Unix. And remember, at that point, I was only into it for 5 years. I bought my first Mac in 95, and by 2000, I'm already an IT manager managing, you know, 50 Macs. Well, it wasn't that many, probably 25 Macs, in a PC Windows NT network. And I was self-taught. I didn't go to college for any of this.
You know, that's an interesting perspective because, you know, I started with an Apple II in 1978 and kind of grew up with the Apple II and the Mac. And so I spent many years before Unix. And so, but I was a physicist and scientist. And so Unix was a no-brainer for me. So the transition
for me
was very well welcomed. You know, because I had used Unix workstations in my work, and I thought, whoa, Apple is so far behind the times, and you don't have authentication and logon, and you don't have protected memory, and can't wait for this company to get away from this decrepit, old-fashioned operating system. So I looked forward to it with enthusiasm, but it's an interesting perspective in your case, because you were kind of new, and then there's this quantum leap that occurs.
It was all new technology that I couldn't troubleshoot, and it scared me.
Oh, ports and demons and...
Oh, everything. Obviously, I learned, and I wasn't of the mindset that I wouldn't be able to learn it. I was of the mindset that I'm going to have to learn this on a professional level while I'm doing the job, and that was daunting. But putting that aside, that Macworld Expo, a lot of people from MyMac came. And at that time, there was the Mac web was a very vibrant and thriving, and there was a lot of really, really creative writing going on in the Apple universe. And most of those people that were involved at that time came to that Macworld Expo. From my Mac, we had me, Adam Carnebogue, who was our webmaster at the time. He was a young guy. Beth Locke, Carmel Glover, Roger Bourne, and there was a couple other ones too. I forget their name.
Roger's no longer with us. He was great.
He was great. And so we had quite a few MyMackers there. But then on the other side, we had Sean King was there. We had you and Joe Ryan and John Farr was there.
Right.
It was exciting, and it was all these people who I've been reading their stuff for many years and corresponding via emails like I was with you.
And there was a group of us, and we were all creating the Mac web ourselves, and we were kind of loathing the day when the big money and the big guys would come in and take it all over.
They did.
Yeah,
well,
they did.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Most of those publications, if you think back, that we were all involved with back then in 2000 are gone now. The only ones that I know exist still are Tidbits.
Yeah, they were very early. Adam was very early with that.
And MyMac, and kind of Macintouch. But that's it. That's the only ones that's really survived all these years. Mac Observer may have just started around then.
I think Brian and Dave started Mac Observer around 96, something like that.
Yeah, I know they came after MyMac, but I don't remember them there. They weren't part of that group that I can remember.
No, I didn't know them at the time.
Mm-mm. And we had a writer's party that you had kind of organized along with Sean King emceeing it.
Yeah, that was cool. And we had Robert Cringely as our guest speaker.
He was awesome.
Yeah, that was great. I wanted to do that every year, but then that August I went to work for Apple.
Yep.
And that kind of tied me up, and I didn't get a chance to do it again and keep doing it.
But that was my favorite Macworld Expo. I've been to many. I was there for the unveiling of the iPhone. But those are the two big ones, obviously. But to me, 2000 is just, I don't know if it'll ever get beat, simply because of the camaraderie that was established from all these very talented writers at the time.
You know, what happens is it's a family, and people, when Apple canceled its Macworlds, people started figuring out other ways to, you know, have family get-togethers.
Yep.
Yeah. So tell me how MyMac has evolved over the years. When we started talking about how it was a downloadable app plus doc maker publication, And then we got onto the internet, and the internet went public somewhere, as I recall, around 96.
96, and, 97, yeah.
Yeah, we started learning how to build these things called websites with servers.
We had one of our writers wanted to create a website for the magazine, and I was, you know, more than happy to let him, as long as I didn't have to do any extra work. And he would basically take, at that point, we released two versions, the doc maker and the PDF version, because PDF was kind of a new thing. And with PDF, Windows users could actually download and read it. Why would Windows users? Well, it was Mac users when they were at work. So they could read my Mac while they're at work on their PC. And it was our Trojan horse. And so he would basically take the PDF version and turn it into our website. And it was pretty rudimentary, you know, at the time, but it worked and it got us online. And, you know, in 2000, we went full on to the web. We decided it didn't really make sense to keep cranking out these downloadable things. And we had a custom site built, and it was run on my own server. It was a colo. It was, colo is when you own the hardware and you send it to a server company.
Oh, okay.
And so they're co-locating your server on their network.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And so it was just a G3 Power Mac sitting there that my web server was running on. I could, I think I would just FTP into it and control it that way. But there was some remote control. I cannot remember the name of it now.
Was that Mac HTTP?
No. You mean the colo company or
no,
how
no,
I got
the,
onto it?
The web server itself on the Mac.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
There was a primitive Mac OS
yep.
9-based web server
yes.
called Mac HTTP.
Yes, that's, yeah. And we used that for, 10 years. I mean, we were kind of stuck there hard coding every single page. And in 2010, we switched over finally to WordPress.
WordPress is pretty cool. I'm starting to learn it now.
There's limitations. Most of the limitations honestly come through my lack of skill on WordPress because I just don't have the time to learn all the things I really should know how to do, but I make do.
Has Julie Cole helped you out? Because she's a WordPress guru.
We've discussed it. But she kind of wants a detailed plan on every single little thing, and I just don't have time to put anything like that together. And I just got done literally with this last 3 weeks. I've been updating the site, so it looks totally different than it did just a month ago now.
So you guys do podcasts, you do product reviews, you do commentary.
Yep.
Do everything.
Yep. The podcasting thing, we started very, very early. I don't remember the first time I saw or heard a podcast, but I know whose it was. It was Adam Curry's. And Adam Curry started podcasting. And I thought, this is kind of a cool idea. This was 2004. That's the year podcasting was invented. And it really lined up with something that an idea that I had had with Rodney O'Lane in 1999, which was to have an
good
audio
old file. Rodney. Oh, we could spend a show talking about him.
Oh, absolutely. But when him and I would talk on the phone, it was so entertaining. We thought we should record these things. And remember 99, 2000, MP3s were a new thing. You know, everybody was going MP3 crazy. You could take an audio mm-hmm. file and shrink it in size. So we thought we could record this telephone conversation between the two of us, put it up at my Mac, and people can download it right from our site. So very, very early idea of podcasting, right? There was no RSS feed and enclosures. You couldn't subscribe to it. You'd have to go to the website to download it. Mm-hmm. But I actually, in 99, recorded an example of what it would be. It had intro music. I talked. I sent it out to the MyMac staff and promptly forgot about it. 2004, Adam Curry invents podcasting, this idea. I tried getting it to work. I couldn't get it to work. Adam Curry actually fixed my RSS feed for me. So we started podcasting in 2004. Initially, the idea was I'll start it, and then one of the staff members will just take over the show. That didn't really happen. And we haven't looked back as far as podcasting. The MyMac podcast is still going strong. I don't record that show myself, but it's still going. In fact, you were on the show three times. You were on, the first one was episode 78 with Daphne Califron. She's the one that did that Mac song, that little ditty.
I don't remember that.
That was in April. It was April 20th, 2006.
Oh, that's probably why I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Then you were, I remember writing for you.
Briefly, you didn't write very long for my Mac.
Well, I think, I forget
what it was.
What,
right,
I
mean, after Apple, or was it right?
I think it was when I went to work for Apple and I had to stop writing about my employer.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
And then you were on episode 94, where it was you and David Avery and I talking about WWDC. And that was August of 2006.
David Avery, was he the martial arts guy who had a website?
Makito, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he works for Adobe. He's been Adobe for a long time now.
Oh, if you've got a contact information for him, I'm going to renew that relationship. He was very
absolutely
cool. Yeah.
And then you, the last time you were on was September 14th, 2006, episode number 98. And it says, the big new products from Apple are discussed, including the new iTV, iPods, iPod Nano, and Shuffles, iTunes 7, and much more.
You have done your homework on me.
Joins us for a segment.
Well, 2006 is after my Apple stint, and I was looking to join another website.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up with the Mac Observer, that year. So it's been 10 years since I joined
the Mac
Observer.
It's been 10 years since. Well, and it was 10 years ago that you were on the MyMac podcast.
Oh, that brings back memories.
Wow. So, I still own the show. I still technically produce it. I put it up on the site, and I do all the web stuff for it. But Guy Searle and Gazmaz actually record that show. I do another show called Tech Fan with David Cohen, who at one time was a co-host on the MyMac podcast.
Cool. Well, guess what? We're just about running out of time here. So we're going to have to wrap it up soon. I was hoping to ask you about one more thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, there is something that I've discussed, and I think that you've discussed. I saw it obliquely on a tweet or at my Mac about the Macintosh problem that Apple has, apparently. At least we've created it for Apple.
Careful. There is no such thing as a Macintosh anymore.
In our minds.
Apple does not make a Macintosh anymore. It's just Mac.
Just Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been rather a long time since Apple has updated the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro and the MacBook Pros. And it's been almost a year since the iMacs have been updated. The only Mac that has been recently updated was the MacBook in 2016. I think that was in April. And so there is this sort of agitation on the internet, as I perceive it, that something's happening. People are starting to get worried about Apple's commitment to the Macs, especially people are worried. Professionals are worried about the Mac Pro.
Well, the Mac Pro was upgraded and updated in 2013.
Yeah, only three years ago.
Yeah, and so it's really running four-year-old technology.
Yes. So are you guys at the MyMac sort of feeling this, too, and writing about it?
Not so much writing about it. I'm talking about it on TechFan. Mm-hmm. I know Guy and Gaz have talked about it on the MyMac podcast, and I'm hearing it on other shows as well. It's no secret that Apple really wasn't happy with an entire generation of Intel chips, and so they kind of decided to skip it.
Oh, the...
the Haswell?
Haswell.
Yeah. And so, I think Apple miscalculated. I don't think they thought it was going to take Intel as long as it has
for the Skylakes.
Exactly, and I think that has a lot to do with it. Remember, Apple is a chip maker themselves now too.
So I know.
A lot of speculation.
There's always rumors. You're going to tell us about the rumor.
Well, I don't think it's a true rumor. There are people who think Apple wants to transition the Mac to the ARM chip. Mm-hmm. I don't think they do. I think they absolutely probably have one running in a back room at Apple, but it doesn't make a lot of sense for them to do so.
I'm not very enthusiastic about that because you'd have to come up with some sort of Rosetta thing to continue to allow people to run their Intel binaries. The developers would be squawking about how to recompile everything for optimum performance.
Yeah, I don't think it's going
to
happen.
Virtual machines. People like to run Parallels and VMware Fusion and then run Windows on their Macs, and then that would wrap things around the axle unless Parallels came out with a version that could somehow
and they would
run Intel binaries and a virtual machine on an ARM-based Mac. It'd be crazy.
It would be. Well, remember, though, Microsoft actually developed Windows 8 to run on an ARM chip.
Yeah, that's true, but that was a failed
experiment. That was a disaster.
Yeah.
And I think Apple probably learned something from that, that I don't think ARM is powerful enough to do everything that we kind of demand of a modern Mac to do. And am I worried that Apple is abandoning the Mac or not giving it the love? Well, they're obviously not giving it the love.
Yeah.
I just think it's, for a company like Apple, they have a limited focus. And that focus the last few years have been on iOS. That's where the explosive growth is happening.
If you had to look into your crystal ball and project an Apple event in October, you know, September 7th, we'll hear about new Apple Watch and
iPhone 7,
we think. So if there were an October event for the Mac, what do you think it would be about?
It'll be about the MacBook Pro 13 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
They'll throw a Mac Mini upgrade in there as well.
You think so?
Yep. But you won't see anything for the Mac Pro until the next WWDC.
Why do you say that?
It's a developer machine. That's the number one audience is graphic designers and developers for the Mac Pro.
Why didn't they do it this year at WWDC?
Well, that's a good question. I mean
the Skylake
processor
was available.
Yeah. Again, I think it's the limited focus. Everyone thinks, well, Apple's got, you know, billions of dollars, but
big money, but a small executive team.
Yes, smallish. And they don't have as many engineers on staff as you may think. And let's be honest, if you're an engineer, if you're a younger engineer right now, Apple is an older company. Do you want to go and spend your time by yourself out of the public spotlight, because we know how secretive Apple can be, mm-hmm. toiling along making the next Mac Pro or the next Mac Mini? Or do you want to go to a more progressive company that could go, you know, big Wall Street and your stock options all of a sudden become worth millions of dollars?
Or work for Google and artificial intelligence and autonomous cars.
And that's the other part of Apple that a lot of people ignore is the fact that, yeah, they have these engineers, but maybe they're not working on the Mac for a reason. Maybe they're working on Apple's car project,
Bob Mansfield is a senior Apple engineer.
I've met him.
He got pulled over to the car project, we heard.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I met him in person. He came in when I took over a Mac specialist back in 2010. Yeah, somewhere around there. And they were coming through Chicago at the time, and they wanted to stop in and meet me since I had just got there. And that was kind of daunting to meet someone of his stature from Apple. And, you know, nice. I think that is why we're not seeing the upgraded Mac line at all. It's just kind of stagnant. And I think it's going to change, at least for the portables and the Mac Mini. But I just seriously doubt that they're going to. They kind of look, Apple backed themselves in the corner with the Mac Pro. Right? With the last generation of Mac Pros, the case really didn't have to change, and you could radically change the hardware inside of it. How do you radically change, from an engineering standpoint at Apple, the Mac Pro? You really can't. There's only so much. You have to redesign a completely new motherboard to fit into this very specialized case. It was cool looking at first, I guess. But I don't know too many people who wanted that Mac Pro.
Talking to you on one.
Well,
I did. I wanted it.
But why? I mean, would you have?
Because it's just so darn cool and small.
Right.
And it's everything I needed to do, and I could let me pick my own display.
But see, there is that. But there's not anything you're doing on that Mac Pro that I can't do on my 2012 15-inch MacBook Pro. There's nothing that you can do that I can't.
Well, I kind of fell out of MacBook Pros when I was running Parallels a lot, and I needed a lot of horsepower to run multiple virtual machines. And at least the older generation MacBook Pros I was using were Core 2 Duos, and they couldn't run Parallels. And,
right. Well, this one's an i7.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's maxed out on RAM. It's got a big, SSD.
A quad core MacBook Pro with 16 gig of RAM and a 256 SSD is going to cost you $2,500.
Yeah, but your machine costs $3,000.
Well, I got a discount.
Yeah, but most people don't get that discount.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's my point. That, and if you look at the entire computer lineup out there, not just from Apple, but from Dell and HP and everybody, you're not seeing these great big huge leaps and bounds on speed and new technologies and wow bang thing. It's not evolutionary. It's evolutionary. It's not revolutionary, but it's barely evolutionary. I mean, Moore's law was broken a while ago, and I don't know. I just feel like there's going to be something big that's going to happen. I don't think Apple is going to abandon the Mac line. Number one, without the Mac line, there is no iOS because you can't develop anything on iOS on a PC, right? So there's that.
That's right.
And I think there's
the technical
coming.
Professionals too. You know, there's the Final Cut Pro people. There's the scientists and engineers.
Everybody at Apple uses Mac.
Yeah.
They're not using PCs, and they're not using.
Well, they're probably using iMacs. You know, Tim Cook has probably a 5K iMac on his desk, from what I've seen. Yeah, that's fine unless you want to do your own display.
Well, you can still put another display on there.
Yeah, I know. I had a mixture of that. I used to have a 2010 iMac with a glossy display, and I didn't like it at all. And I had an external display that wasn't so glossy, and I just fell in love with non-glossy displays. And
so, I've got a 27-inch Asus that's hooked up to my MacBook Pro. My MacBook Pro is closed. I never use its built-in screen.
Yeah. So we may all be buying MacBook Pros connecting to our screens from now on. We'll see. Well, we really are out of time. It's been interesting. We'll just have to wait to see what Apple does, if they even have a Macintosh event in October. We're crossing our fingers. And so we'll just have to wait and see. Tim, thanks so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. It's been fun reminiscing with you, fun chatting.
Oh, I had a great time. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Well, on Twitter, I am either, at MyMac or at TechFanPodcast. Either one of them, I check on a, you know, hourly basis. I get the notifications on my phone. I am on Facebook, obviously. And the easiest way, though, is just to send feedback at MyMac.com, and it all routes through me.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we'll put those in the show notes. Make sure people know how to contact you and learn about you. Well, listeners, thank you very much for coming by. I hope you enjoyed the show and Tim and my chatting about the old times and the origins of the Mac Web. And so we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.